This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Nancy Hollander about the role she was depicted in the new film, The Mauritanian.
Imagine having Jodie Foster play you in a movie.
We talk with best-selling author Bruce Levine about his new book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary and Fighter for Racial Justice.
This book couldn't be more timely with the advent of the Black Lives Matter movement and the fulfillment of the American Revolution.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
In 2019, Law and Disorder interviewed Nancy Hollander as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series. Nancy secured whistleblower Chelsea Manning's release in 2017 when President Obama commuted her sentence from 35 to 7 years. Nancy was also an attorney in the landmark Holy Land 5 case. In her law practice, she frequently represents individuals and organizations accused of crimes involving national security. We also spoke with Nancy in 2018 about her client Mohamedou Slahi, whose release she obtained after he served 15 years in the American offshore prison camp in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, without ever being charged of a crime. Slahi wrote a memoir about his experience in prison called Guantanamo Diary, where he was tortured in ways personally approved by then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Thanks to Nancy, the book was published in 2015. It became an international bestseller. Fast forward to 2021. A new film called The Mauritanian features Jodie Foster playing the character of Nancy. Foster has already won a Golden Globe for her performance, and the film sheds light on Nancy's tenacious fight to free her client, the secretive prison camp, and the many illegal practices therein. Nancy practices criminal defense in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she's been a partner since 1980 in the law firm of Friedman, Boyd, Hollander, Goldman, Urias, and Ward. Nancy, welcome back to Law and Disorder, and congratulations on making it to the silver screen.
Thank you. I'm always happy to be here.
Nancy, we love the scene in The Mauritanian in which you tell your law firm partners that you're going to take Mohamedou's case. Is that how it played out in real life? And when did your partners come around to the case's significance in U.S. history?
It didn't quite start that way. I don't remember entirely. I'm sure there was someone who said, what is this going to cost? You know, have you thought about it? But I also remember someone else saying, this is why we became lawyers. Just go and do it and we'll work it out. I think that my partners came around to what it meant about the same time I did. We all are pretty much on the same track. We do a lot of pro bono work. We all have more or less the same politics, I would say, certainly in terms of things like this.
Yeah, I recall Michael Ratner initiating the discussion at the CCR, and initially he got resistance, and finally they came around too.
Right, right. Well, I had resistance. I was not sure we should get involved in any Guantanamo cases initially because we didn't want to give them credibility. But it didn't take me very long after somebody said, if we don't represent these people, they're going to get bad lawyers. And so that's about all it took for me.
So how involved were you in the consulting pre-production? For example, was there an agreement on how much of the torture scenes to include, and how would they be shot?
I didn't have anything to do with the torture scenes. I was involved all the way through. I gave the screenwriters information. I gave them transcripts. And then once Kevin had attached the director, I talked to him but I didn't have anything to do with the torture scenes.
Nancy, was there a lot of red tape in terms of what the director and producers had to go through vis-a-vis the U.S. government? I assume, for example, the Guantanamo shots were not really Guantanamo.
There was no red tape because the government wasn't involved at all. All of the filming was done either in South Africa in Cape Town or in Mauritania. The scenes from Mauritania were shot in Mauritania. Everything else was shot in Cape Town, where they make a great many movies. The sets were produced out of nothing. That was just empty space, and they reproduced Guantanamo.
Nancy, how did Jodie Foster learn your demeanor and your mannerisms, and what is she like? I saw an interview with her where she said, I'm not like Nancy Hollander, she's nicer.
Right. She keeps saying that she's played a meaner Nancy than I am. And she warned me that this would not be an impersonation. But I first met Jodie, actually we were both in London, and I think my first sentence to her was, nobody's ever played me before. And her first sentence to me was, well, I've never played a real live person before either. And so that's kind of how we started. She's a delightful, interesting, funny, thoughtful person. She came to my apartment in New York, and we spent several hours together. She has described that she walked around and asked me about things in my apartment. She's quick. She's been acting since she was 3 years old. She knows how to do this stuff. And she picked up a lot. We talked after that. She asked me some questions about various things. For example, if you're talking about a case in the courtroom, would you have it in front of you? Would you refer to it? Would you quote from it? Things like that that she didn't know. You may know and may have seen that she, Shailene, and Kevin all gave videos to Amnesty recently demanding that Guantanamo be closed. So she feels very strongly politically in this movie and entered it because she cared about it.
Nancy, how did Mahamadou feel about the film, and was he involved in consulting for it?
Well, Mahamadou loves the movie. He was involved in producing it once we got into the movie stage. However, I signed the contract for this movie in 2015 when Mahamadou was still in prison. Right after the book came out, Lloyd Levin and Bale Levin came to me with an option. They wanted to produce the movie. And the original idea was that it would help get him out, just like we thought the book would help him get him out. And then the movie didn't happen until years later. So now we hope the movie will get the other 40 out.
Nancy, tell us about Mahamadou's relationship with the guard who visited him at his home in Mauritania after his release. The scene where Mahamadou addresses the court shows the guard watching him.
Yeah, this guard was Steve Wood, and Steve and Mahamadou are actually in a documentary that The Guardian has produced. It's available on The Guardian. They don't have a paywall. It's called My Brother's Keeper. It's a 20-minute documentary that I encourage everyone to see. Steve called me when Mahamadou was still in prison when the book came out and wanted to know what had happened to him. We got in communication. He got in communication with Mahamadou when he got out. He's been to Mauritania twice. He's converted to Islam, and he's just a lovely guy. So they developed this relationship in 2005 because Mahamadou had his own guard force, and he and Steve got to be friends.
Yes, he had such a wonderful spirit. It's no wonder. Nancy, at the closing credits, the film noted that Mahamadou married an American attorney and they have a child together. Was that Terry Duncan who worked with you?
No. Let me say about Terry. She's not anything like she's shown in the movie. The real Terry Duncan is an accomplished, experienced, highly respected death penalty lawyer now. She was my associate at the time, became a partner in my firm, and then started her own firm so she could do death penalty work. And the lawyer that he married, the lawyer who he married is a woman named Kitty, and Kitty was a law student working on Guantanamo cases when she learned about Mahamudu. They started to communicate, and he was already out. She went to visit him. They fell in love, and now they have a baby, Ahmed, who is, by the way, my godchild.
That's very nice.
Lovely.
Talk about Lieutenant Colonel Stuart Couch. His enlightenment marked a turning point in the film. Did Benedict Cumberbatch capture the essence of him?
Benedict did capture the essence of Stu Couch. The movie has the time sequences in a different order. Stu and I did not really meet in the little place off the gift shop. There is a gift shop in Guantanamo, and there are restaurants there, including an Irish pub. Isn't there an Irish pub everywhere in the world? But we didn't meet then. I don't drink beer in any form, but that's neither here nor there. Stu and I did meet later, and what it says about him is true. He asked his Marine friends, and they said, "Do your job." And he went to church. It was a baptism. The minister did say every human being has dignity, and that did it for him. There was an article written in the Wall Street Journal called The Conscience of the Colonel, and that's really where we learned about him. And it's also where we learned that they were considering the death penalty for Mahamudu. Stu originally believed that Mahamudu was guilty, but that they just hadn't found the evidence. But he came around, and he did say that if you've convinced Judge Robertson, you've convinced me. He's now an immigration appellate judge working for the Department of Justice, but he's completely come around, and he's very excited about the movie also.
The film portrays Mahamudu as amazingly upbeat and funny, even at his low points. How has he adjusted to life in Mauritania after his ordeal?
Well, he is a funny guy. There were low points in Guantanamo where he wasn't so funny and where I was worried about him because I felt like he was getting depressed. You know, there were long years when nothing was happening. Between 2005 and 2008, we were doing all the research and discovery we could do. We really did file a Freedom of Information Act request. And then after that, we filed motions to compel to get discovery. We had to work hard to get the MFRs, as it talks about in the movie, the Memorandum for Record. It's not correct that Stu is the one who found the polygraphs. Mahamudu told us about them, and it took us a long time and a lot of arguing and discovery to finally get them from the government, but we did. But after he's gotten to Mauritania, you know, he's just been so much a hero there. I could tell you story after story. On our way from the airport, we got stopped for speeding until the cop realized who he was, and that was the end of that, you know. And I arrived in Mauritania. I put a scarf on as I got off the plane, and Mahamudu walks up to me and says, "Nancy, there is no dress code here." He'd been out of prison 2 days. And I said to him, "Dude, how about hello? I'm free. Thank you." And he just laughed. And you know, that's the way he is. He is funny. He is so, so smart. He's incredibly empathetic, which is how he figured out things about his guards, how he's very observant. It's how he figured out where he was and what people's real names were. He speaks several languages. He wrote everything in English. He's written a new book, a novel about Bedouins that's just come out. The story of Ahmed and Zarga, about a Bedouin who has lost his camel. It's a delightful little novel. The actual true story of Ahmed and Zarga, Z-A-R-G-A, published by the Ohio University Press, just came out. It's a wonderful little novel. You'll learn everything you ever needed to know about Bedouin superstitions. Now, Mohamedou is a Bedouin. Well, if you notice the scenes in the movie with the camels and the flashbacks of him and his father was a Bedouin camel herder.
Nancy, what impact has the film had on U.S. audiences, to the best of your knowledge?
You know, I don't know what impact the film has had on U.S. audiences. I hope that its impact is for them to understand that we did this kind of torture, that when the U.S. government thought no one could see it, no one was watching, it got away with a lot that it should not have, and that we have to work to make sure that doesn't continue to happen. I hope that the U.S. audiences understand that revenge has no place for governments or people, and we should, we should think about what Mohamedou says about forgiveness. That doesn't mean that torture should not be prosecuted, and that's not what I'm saying at all, because I think under the law and the treaties that the U.S. has signed, we're obligated to consider the prosecutions of torturers. But I want also American audiences to understand that we really are one people and one race, and you know that you shouldn't put Muslims into a box.
Nancy, a month ago, Variety magazine predicted that The Mauritanian would be nominated for Best Picture Award. But the day before we taped this, the Oscar nominees were announced, and it wasn't up for any category. Do you think the film was just too close to the truth for this country?
I don't know why it wasn't nominated. Everyone thought it would be nominated. There were a lot of other films that and individuals that people thought would be nominated who didn't get Oscars this year. But I don't know. Maybe America isn't ready for this yet. You know that Jodi did get Golden Globe for Best Supporting Witness, and we've been nominated for 5 BAFTAs. The BAFTAs are the British equivalent of the Oscars. But so we're hopeful about those. They're very important in Europe. But I don't know. I think the film is going to, frankly, do better in other countries than in the United States. It's going to be out in London April 1st, in Paris and France April 7th. It's doing very well in the Middle East, in Saudi Arabia, and it's coming out all over the world. And I think in other countries it will do better than in the United States.
So in the wake of the film, what does the campaign to close Guantanamo, where does it stand, and who supports it? I saw that the ACLU has gotten behind the campaign to close Guantanamo. So has the movement picked up something because of the film?
Well, I hope the film is helping the movement pick up. The ACLU's behind it, of course. Amnesty's behind it. We really want one of the things that comes out of this film to be the beginning of again of that conversation, pushing the conversation. President Biden said he wanted to close Guantanamo, and if there is the political will to do it, it can happen. You know, there's 6 people there who were cleared for release already. One of them was cleared in 2009. Those people should just go home or go where they'll be safe. That should be easy for the government. Then the other, quote, forever prisoners, whatever that means. We don't have people in prison forever in this country who've not even been charged with a crime. Those people go home. And then we're left with the ones who've been charged. They're the most complicated, but they need all due process rights to resolve their cases, not the military commission, which is not, again, anything that resembles American justice. And it can be done. I believe it can be done in 4 years, but there has to be the political will to do it because it will take work.
I remember that famous quote by Clemenceau, the French president, who said, military justice is to justice as military music is to music.
Right. Well, you know, the universal code of military justice is not a bad system in this country, but that's not what the military commissions are. The military commissions are not military justice. There's some new creation. For example, there's no right to confrontation in the military commissions. There's no right to a speedy trial. Those things do exist in the military code, but they don't exist in the military commissions. Tortured statements can be used if reliable. I mean, there's a lot of things about them that make no sense. And the fact that these people have been charged, including my other client, Ibrahim al-Nasri, charged and captured since 2002 and have yet to be tried.
Nancy, we're running out of our allotted time. What are you working on now, if you are able to discuss it?
Well, I'm happy to discuss it. In addition to working on everything I can to promote this film everywhere, I'm working on the case of Ibrahim al-Nasri, who's charged with being the mastermind behind the blowing up of the USS Cole in the port of Aden, Yemen in October of 2000. I primarily do his European work. We have a case in the UK. We believe MI6 interrogated him when he was under torture. Not that they tortured him, but they interrogated him. We have a case in the European Court of Human Rights. We already won two cases for him in that court, got 200,000 euros for his family. And we have a case in the International Criminal Court, which we're hoping to start up again as soon as the executive order that made that difficult is changed somehow. So, yes, plus his military commission case, but that case doesn't go very far, and I'm trying to do the next best thing, which is to get him accountability and for what happened to him. He was tortured in the black sites, and get damages for his family. So that's primarily what I'm working on.
Nancy, we're at the end of the line here. We have to say goodbye, but before we do that, can you tell our listeners how they can follow you and learn more about your work?
Well, I'm on Twitter, although I don't do much on Twitter. You know, they can email me, I suppose. That's probably the easiest thing. I'm always available to talk to people and happy to do that. They can find me easily on my website. You know, you put in my name, I show up.
Great.
Nancy, it's just always a joy to talk to you. We're very excited about this film.
Well, thank you both. It's always great to talk to you. And yes, tell everyone you know to rent this movie.
We've been doing that, and we're going to continue doing that. Nancy Hollander, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having Law and Disorder for me to be on.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
The 1861 to 1865 American Civil War and the Reconstruction period, which followed, is considered to be the second American Revolution. The slave-owning planter class in the South was defeated, at least for a while. Slave labor was abolished, but came back in other forms after Reconstruction was crushed in 1877. The promise of the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal before the law, was fulfilled, at least for a while. Pennsylvania Congressman Thaddeus Stevens was the foremost leader in the struggle, even more so than Abraham Lincoln. Stevens helped to bring about the destruction of slavery and was a leader in the effort during the Reconstruction period to make the United States a biracial democracy. This wise and eloquent revolutionary has been vilified and rendered obscure since he died 153 years ago. The distinguished historian Bruce Levine, in his just-published biography of Stevens called Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary Fighter for Racial Justice, has secured a place for him alongside his contemporary John Brown in the pantheon of American revolutionary figures. We speak today with Bruce Levine. He's the Emeritus Professor of History at the University of Illinois and the author of four books on the Civil War. Bruce Levine, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Bruce, why is the Civil War and Reconstruction that followed it called the Second American Revolution?
Because what it does is overthrows the economic and social order in about half of the country. Slave labor was the basis of the economy, political structure, social relationships, even the culture of the southern states. And by abolishing slavery, those societies were indeed revolutionized. More broadly, the first American Revolution, the War for Independence, began a process of democratic revolution by pulling the land out from under the control of the British Empire and establishing self-government for the region. The Second American Revolution sought to democratize that society further by extending equal rights to all.
Thaddeus Stevens, like Abraham Lincoln, was a very successful lawyer. He was originally from Vermont, but he moved and practiced in Lancaster County in southern Pennsylvania. Then he went to Congress representing the area of Pennsylvania. What political values and morals did he bring with him from rural Vermont? Please talk about the influence of his mother and her Baptist faith.
Vermont had a big impact on Stevens, I'm absolutely convinced. Earlier biographers have paid very little attention to this fact, but Vermont was the most radical of the early states in the Union. It was born in a struggle against the state of New York, which was politically heavily influenced by enormously wealthy landowners in the Hudson and other valleys who owned estates as big as modern counties, and whose tenants had few, if any, rights, property rights, political rights, what have you. Vermonters, or what became known as the residents of Vermont, struggled against that control, struggled to own their own small farms, and the state of Vermont that's born of that struggle lives in that political tradition. It is very democratic-minded. It creates for itself one of the most, if not the most, democratic state constitutions. And it is the first state in the Union whose very constitution denounces slavery. So Stevens, who grew up in that atmosphere, he doesn't leave Vermont until it's time to go off to college, is heavily influenced by that. He remembers vividly in years later that his family venerated the most democratic document of the first American Revolution, Declaration of Independence. The Baptist faith of his parents was a faith born in and prominent in the English Revolution of the 17th century that brought down the English monarchy, and it prized personal conscience, personal decision-making, and community cohesion, placed the good of the community above the good of the individual, and that also influenced Stevens and pushed him in the direction not only of individual rights, but of the importance of the community. His mother deeply imbued him with those values, and his mother lived those values before his eyes.
Lincoln's initial priority wasn't the abolition of slavery, but it was in keeping the Union together after the Southern states seceded. The Civil War commenced when troops from South Carolina fired on a federal fort. The North could not have been won without the participation of former slaves, and Lincoln came to realize that. Approximately one-eighth of the Union Army was made up of these men. What did Stevens do to push Lincoln in this direction?
Stevens began calling upon the Union government to bring black men into its lily-white armies virtually from the very beginning of the war. And Lincoln resisted doing so, as Lincoln resisted so many of the things that Stevens advocated and which Lincoln was eventually compelled to agree with. And Stevens kept up this relentless pressure and helped thereby to increase public opinion in favor of doing so. That is something he did in general across the board with policies that, again, Lincoln initially resisted, but which Thaddeus Stevens made it possible for him eventually to accept precisely by helping to prepare public opinion for them. And just as you say, Lincoln eventually comes to recognize that those like Stevens who had been pushing for the admission of black men into the army were right, and that the war could indeed not be won without that radical change in policy. Others who came to see the same thing included Ulysses Grant.
Bruce, your book is so beautifully written. I wonder whether you could read for us. One of my favorite passages is on page 168. Do you think you could read that for us, please?
Okay, I'll do my best. This is a discussion of the 13th Amendment. Success in the House came some 7 months later. On the afternoon of January 31st, 1865, Thaddeus Stevens rose to conclude the Republican case for abolition. Other House members immediately crowded around to hear his words, while senators, Supreme Court justices, and other highly placed individuals filled the galleries and the lobbies. The House then passed the 13th Amendment in a vote of 119 to 56. When the result was announced, the chamber's floor and galleries erupted in cheers, tears, and ecstatic shouts of celebration. Months of both arm-twisting and bargaining had played their part in that outcome, but so had Republican gains during the 1864 congressional elections, likely changing the minds of some Democratic representatives then sitting about which way the political winds were blowing. The 13th Amendment then went to the state legislatures for approval. For the aging Stevens, Congress's endorsement of a step for which he had been fighting for so long could only have been gratifying. His health was declining, as was apparent to those around him. But, he said, quote, "If Providence should spare me a little longer, until the day when the foot of a slave can never again tread upon the soil of the Republic, I shall be content to accept any lot which may await me, end quote. The Ohio Democrat George H. Pendleton accused Republicans in May 1864 of being a, quote, revolutionary, end quote, party, and demanded they acknowledge it, quote, admit you are in a revolution. Admit that you are revolutionists. Admit that you do not desire to restore the old order. Admit that you do not fight to restore the Union. Take the responsibility for that position, end quote. But such a challenge held no terrors for Thaddeus Stevens, who extolled what he called the purifying fires of this revolution and assured his listeners that, quote, revolution it is, end quote. By early December 1865, the states had ratified the new constitutional amendment. Slavery was outlawed throughout the country.
Thank you, Bruce. Bruce, along with Donald Trump, Andrew Johnson is considered the worst president ever inflicted on the American people. He was Lincoln's vice president and ascended to the presidency in 1865 after Lincoln was assassinated and the Civil War had ended. What did Johnson do to obstruct Reconstruction, and how did Stevens respond to that?
From very early after assuming the presidency, Andrew Johnson begins pardoning wholesale the leadership of the now dead Confederacy and restoring to them all their rights except the outright ownership of human beings. The consequence is that as early as the fall of 1865, the states of the dead Confederacy are now acting as though they are full-fledged members of the Union once again. They are electing their own state legislatures and filling them with leaders of the ex-Confederacy, and they are sending Confederate leaders and generals and colonels to the United States House of Representatives and the United States Senate. The Republicans refuse to allow this to occur and block it and begin to try to implement a more severe form of Reconstruction, and eventually begin passing civil rights legislation and begin crafting what becomes the 14th Amendment. Andrew Johnson vetoes the civil rights law and tries to veto the 14th Amendment and encourages the southern states to refuse to ratify the 14th Amendment. When Congress places the states of the ex-Confederacy under the ultimate control of Union generals who are charged with protecting the lives and the rights of former slaves as well as of those whites in the South who had been loyal to the Union, Johnson moves to restrict the power of those generals and then begins to replace them one after another with those he considers more liable to be complicit in the white supremacist action of the southern state leaders. Johnson also tries to blackmail Congress out of its ability to pass laws by declaring that until Congress brings all these states back into full standing, everything they do is legally suspect. And it is upon such grounds that the House of Representatives eventually impeaches Andrew Johnson.
If Stevens would have had his way, what would Reconstruction have looked like?
Well, first of all, he would have denied them the rights of other states. Those states, the states that formed the Confederacy in 1860-61, declare they're out of the Union. Thaddeus Stevens says, fine, they're out of the Union. Let us treat them as such. Let us treat them as what they really are, an enemy alien state. And once we have conquered them, treat them as what they are, in fact, conquered enemy provinces. Let us rule them directly from Washington, as we do all other territories, and let us use that rule to enforce not only the abolition of slavery, but the enactment of equal civil rights, equality before the law, insofar as we restore self-government, let us require the extension of that suffrage to adult black men, and let us furthermore provide an economic foundation for greater democracy in the South by taking all the estates owned by the slaveholding aristocracy, the richest slave owners, confiscate that land, divide that land into small farms, and distribute it among those whose labor had cultivated that land and made that land profitable in the first place. Meanwhile, let us strip the leadership of the old Confederacy of its rights to vote and its rights to hold political office. And in that way, let us make sure that we reshape the South into genuine egalitarian democracies.
Seven and eight, because
sure.
We have it's good because it's going to get duplicative, and
yeah,
just and move on to nine.
Okay, great. Bruce, what is meant by reparations, and do you believe Stevens was an early proponent of reparations? Now, reparations are under consideration by many in America.
Well, I understand reparations to mean doing something to compensate slaves and those descended from slaves for the very fact of enslavement, and moreover, for the era of Jim Crow that lasted approximately a century after the end of outright slavery. To do something, to give something that would enable the lifting of this still oppressed portion of the population out of the bottom tier of American society. I think Stevens, although he didn't use these words, was, of course, a proponent of reparations, because that's what dividing plantation lands and giving it to the former slaves constituted, an attempt to give back what was taken away in the first place, the result of centuries of unpaid labor by those slaves and their ancestors.
Stevens was not only for enfranchising black males, but he was for other progressive things as well. Bruce, please elaborate on his position on women's suffrage and the rights of Chinese immigrants.
Over the course of his life, Stevens' commitment to democratic causes grows. It is propelled forward not only by his early values, but also by the problems that arise before his eyes in American society. And so he responds by deepening his commitment to democracy. And thus it is that on the eve of the Civil War, Stevens in Lancaster places himself on the side of those arguing in favor of women's right to vote. And at the same time, when members of his own political party, the Republican Party in California, come before the United States Congress asking it to enforce one or another provision that will make life even harder for the impoverished immigrants from China who are reaching the shores of California, Thaddeus Stevens not only refuses to support such measures, but denounces the state of California for its treatment of those immigrants and insists instead that they have every right to come here, that this is supposed to be the land of refuge and freedom, and that California is casting shame upon itself by its conduct toward these residents.
Your book is remarkably timely given the upsurge of 20 million people led by black Americans in the streets in June last year. How do you relate Stevens to the current Black Lives Matter movement?
If Thaddeus Stevens were alive today, and if he were ambulatory, which he was not in his last years due to illness, but if he were, he'd have been in the midst of those marches. Thaddeus Stevens, all through his life, fought against racist violence committed against black people. And that kind of racist violence was eventually key to the process of overturning Reconstruction in the South. In the almost immediate aftermath of the Civil War, white riots against the former slaves broke out in one place after another in the former Confederacy, most bloodily in the cities of Memphis and New Orleans. And the rioters, by the way, in both cases, included large numbers of white police. And that is another fact that has been characteristic of the entire era since the end of the Civil War. White police violence directed against black people, supplemented by white supremacist vigilante violence against white people, against black people, which we've also seen in the last year or so. So Stevens would have been an active supporter of Black Lives Matter today.
Bruce, how has your book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice, been received?
Well, Heidi, it's still early. The book has only been in print now for about 2 weeks. I'm happy to say, though, that most initial reactions have been very positive. A number of authors whom I respect deeply and whom have received accolades for their own work have said very kind things about the book, which my publisher has thankfully reprinted on the back of the book. And in the first week or so of sales, about 1,000 copies of the book have been sold in one format or another. So far, the book bids fair to do well and hopefully to influence popular opinion in its own right.
We're coming to the end of our allotted time, but let me just ask you this. What would you like people to take away after they've read your biography of Stevens?
Well, I hope they'll be reminded of a number of things. First of all, how old racism is in this country, how deeply rooted is the oppression and victimization of African Americans in this country, but also through the example of the Civil War and the fight for equality during Reconstruction, what courage and determination can accomplish in struggle against those things. Thaddeus Stevens, I hope, will help inspire people, even more than they already may be, to fight hard and long for the achievement of genuine political and social democracy in the United States.
Bruce Levine, it's been a great pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Your book, Thaddeus Stevens, Civil War Revolutionary, Fighter for Racial Justice, published. We're glad to hear that it's doing so well, and we're grateful to be able to speak with you today. You take it easy.
Thank you so much for having me on, folks. I appreciate it a great deal.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
We're going to close out listening to Pete Seeger sing the John Brown song. John Brown was greatly admired by Thaddeus Stevens. Brown, like Stevens, has been reduced to obscurity and vilified since his death back in 1860. Brown, the year before, had led a raid on Harper's Ferry, a federal arsenal in Virginia. The raid didn't go off. Brown had intended to grab weapons at the arsenal, distribute them to slaves, and lead a slave uprising. It didn't work. Brown was captured and executed, but became a hero in the North. And the song that Pete Seeger is going to sing is a song that the Northern troops, black and white, sang during the entire Civil War.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. But his soul goes marching on. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down. The stars above in heaven are looking kindly down on the grave of old John Brown. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. He captured Harper's Ferry with his 19 men so true. He frightened old Virginia till she trembled through and through. They hanged him for a traitor, they themselves the traitor crew. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. Well, he's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord. He's gone to be a soldier in the army of the Lord, but his soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath is stored. He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul.
Bush war town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around. The white folks in Washington, they know how. Took a colored man, a nigga, just to see him bow. Lord, it's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues, I'm gonna spread the news all around. Tell all the colored folks to listen to me. Don't try to find no home in Washington, D.C., cause there's a bourgeois town. It's a bourgeois town. I got the bourgeois blues and I'm still gonna spread the news.